Welcome to The Derivative by RCM Alternatives, where we dive into what makes alternative investments go, analyze the strategies of unique hedge fund managers, and chat with interesting guests from across the investment world. Hello there. Producer Jeff was telling me he should come up with something new this year. I don't know. I'm sticking with the Obi-Wan Kenobi line for now. Maybe we'll change it up a little bit later. But welcome back, everyone. Did you miss me? I missed you, to be sure. There was Thanksgiving, then the holiday party circuit, then family here in Chicago over the holidays, New Year's Eve, some skiing. Yes, of course, some skiing. Miami Hedge Fund Week, and boom, before you know it, we're here a few days before the Super Bowl. Glad to be back. All that happened since we left was a seemingly straight-up equity market. Pretty poor managed futures performance in November, December, although bouncing back here in Jan and Feb. And the floor just completely falling out of volatility, with readings showing some of the lowest prices to purchase put protection on record. We'll be sure to get into that on a future episode. What will the new year bring? With stocks back at all-time highs, rates having stopped going up, sort of. Crypto making noise, the Ukraine war still going on, Middle East seemingly getting worse, not better, and all the rest. I have no idea. And to be honest, most of our guests will have no idea either. They're mostly quants modeling strategies that do what they do no matter which way the wind is blowing, which is what, to me, makes them so interesting. How do you do that? How do you turn off that part of your brain that doesn't really care what's going on out there in the world? We'll be bringing you a lot of good ones this season, so go smash that subscribe button, as the kids say, which really means just subscribe to the pod, please, on your favorite platform so we can keep building that audience, which helps us keep getting these great guests. All right, enough about that. Let's get back to the swing of things here. I put to several guests throughout last year, if you can remember, what they thought of managed futures replication strategies. Most run their own funds, so were understandably dubious of the approach. Throughout those questions, I was mostly implying, if not outright saying a few times, Andrew Beer and his managed futures replication strategy. Will it work? Well, it seemed appropriate to go to the source and get his views after hearing all the pans and wonderings about how it could work from others. So we got Andrew on here and talking through just what he's trying to do and also understanding what he's decidedly not trying to do, which is not trying to end the single manager fund business. So let's get to it. Andrew Beer, send it. This episode is brought to you by RCM Alternatives Managed Futures Group. Our guest today offers a product he thinks provides a beta to the managed futures space. For those who are seeking to outperform that beta, RCM's team helps identify and gain access to single manager managed accounts and funds that are designed to be better than the average. They won't all be, of course. That's how averages work. But the Managed Futures Group believes with its filtering tools and ranking methodology, you can greatly improve your chances. Learn more at rcmalts.com. And now back to the show. All right, we are here with Andrew Beer, who has the fake New York skyline behind him, even though he is in the actual New York. What's the real view? Just a brick wall or something? So you need to cover it with that, or?
I just moved 2 weeks ago. You have a largely empty room behind me, but you hear an echo, it's because, unlike you, I don't have the nice furniture making my office comfortable yet.
Where'd you move to?
To a place called Darien, Connecticut.
So
I spent decades living in Connecticut, and past several years I've been in New York and other places. So I'm back.
You're back. I love it. Back. And you're still, what's the status? You're going into Manhattan for work?
I do. Yeah, I go in probably about 2 days a week. For the past 25 years, I've had my own businesses. So even when I've lived outside the city, I've always tried to, balance getting into the city for meetings, stacking it around specific days. But then I spend most of my time doing stuff like this online these days.
Love it. And then take us a little bit through the personal background before we get into the firm. So, born and raised Northeast?
Born and raised in Manhattan. I'm a native. Went to school through high school. Then I went up to Cambridge, Massachusetts for college. Came back to New York. At some point there, I decided I was going to get into business, but it wasn't obvious. And so I started to work as an M&A banker, went back to Harvard for business school, thought I was going down the private equity path, and then a chance interview in my second year, I ended up going down the hedge fund path. So I've been doing that ever since. I'm relatively eclectic in how I've done it. I started working for a very well-known hedge fund manager, as a portfolio manager. I later ended up starting a commodity firm called Pinnacle Asset Management that you may have run into in your business. That was in so interesting story. Back in 2000, I started to get interested in the commodity markets. It was something I didn't know much about, but I could see a couple of things converging and tried to figure out how to make a business out of it. And that ultimately became Pinnacle.
And who was the hedge fund again? I know you've said it on other pods, but shared here.
Oh, the one I went for, you mean the first one that I went to work
The
for?
or the interview and the first
Oh yeah,
hedge fund.
I went to work for this guy named Seth Klarman, who's a very well-known value investor. But my career is, by hedge fund standards, is pretty weird. I started as a value-focused guy looking for eclectic investments anywhere you could find them. Eventually, I end up starting both a hedge fund focused on the commodity markets, but really with a fundamental angle, so different than what we do right now. Called Pinnacle Asset Management, and also around the same time with a different group of guys started one of the earlier Greater China hedge funds. And then my current business is all about trying to bring certain hedge fund strategies to a broader pool of investors through easy to invest in vehicles. So
What do you ever,
I bounced around.
yeah? Do you ever look back and be like, oh, I should have stuck with Klarman? Man,
Always.
maybe I'd
Oh
have
my God.
a few billion in the bank.
The moment I leave a firm, it's about to take off. I mean, my God, I was on a private equity path, and the guys, that I know who went down that path, who just stayed on the path, are I was with a friend of mine in London who's, one of the greats of the space. And he was sitting across the kitchen table. He was saying, remember when I was like, raising a $1 billion fund was a big deal? He said, we just raised a $25 billion fund, and in 6 months we'll raise another one. I mean, just the business has just taken off. And part of my theory on managed futures as a space is that it has that kind of potential, if we can, if we can figure out, if we can fix some things in how it's positioned, for later,
The
presumably.
before I let you off private equity, any worries that space is too big, too inverted, right? It used to be a premium because it was illiquid. Now it's a discount because it's illiquid.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think all these spaces go through when they get institutionalized, and the whole hedge fund industry. I mean, when I look back at the stuff that we were doing at Baupost in the mid 1990s, now, I mean, you look at that stuff compared to what you can do today, and you should have just done everything. There was, because there just weren't that many hedge funds doing this kind of stuff, and so it was kind of you, a handful of guys against the world, and the opportunities were plentiful. Now, every one of those guys has had 20 or 30 guys who've, learned at their knee and have now gone off to start new businesses or gone to other firms. It gets immensely more competitive over time. Private equity is the same thing. Private equity used to be, it was Henry Kravis taking some guy to a box at the opera who happened to run a big conglomerate, doing a handshake deal, taking over one of these undermanaged subsidiaries at, 4 times cash flow. And I mean, just, and having 99-to-1 leverage. But the business has evolved. And what private equity has also done by pivoting into something like tech stocks, is these are really smart guys who figure out how to evolve and adapt over time. Clearly the great opportunities that put these things on the map, those are long behind us.
Right. So would you recommend your kid goes into private equity or not?
I don't know. I mean,
That's the tough one. I'm like,
I've got, oh,
yeah.
I've got one who's two right now. I've got two daughters who are not interested in business in their 20s, and I've got a 2-year-old. So I'm gonna have to, I'll let's talk about the 2-year-old in about 15 years.
Right. That's a big spread. Will there even be jobs then? He'll just be like,
Just
throw something
AI.
in. Yeah, exactly. Basic income for him. A little bit of that background, and we'll get into the firm in a minute, but kind of funny to me that you're kind of running a quant firm, quant model, right? That has to replicate these strategies, but you're not necessarily a quant. So,
Not at all like wants,
not at all
actually.
a quant. I was being polite, but so how do you square that? How did that work out?
Interesting. So I met a quant in, I was pretty well known in the early 2000s as an entrepreneurial guy who could kind of, because like I wasn't a typical hedge fund seeder. I was basically finding an area of the market that I found really interesting and then scrapping together, you know, the people and the business plan and the money and going out and talking to investors. It was fun. I mean, it was in my 30s, it was super active. And in August 2006, I had a meeting with a guy who really was a quant, and he did his PhD from MIT, and he was talking about some sophisticated trading strategy that I said and said, I don't know. I don't know how to evaluate it. And then he brought up this idea of hedge fund replication. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he described it in, I mean, look, I'm not a quant, but I almost did a doctorate at Harvard. I would have had to clean up some of my math, but I'm very comfortable with numbers.
Could have been a quant, right?
Yeah. But he described hedge fund replication, which is really simply just using risk models to figure out kind of the big hedge fund trades.
And this was Andrew Lowe?
No, this was a guy named Jerome Abernathy. It happened to be the same month that Andrew Lowe published his paper.
Hmm.
And for hedge fund guys, that was sort of obvious, right? I mean, in we had just come out of, you know, the dot-com crisis, where if you were long small cap value stocks and short large cap growth, you preserved capital through the great bull market. It didn't matter. It wasn't like, oh, I only bought the three value stocks and shorted the bad. I mean, it just, you got the areas right. Hedge funds have always been getting the areas right. Even the 1990s, you know, I mean, when Baupost was finding really esoteric ways to make money, they were doing things like buying Russian privatization vouchers. Well, again, it was so cheap. Things were 1/100th of what they were worth in the West that it almost didn't matter what you bought. You had to find the right areas. So the idea that you could apply a risk model and say, hey, these are the big hedge funds, big trades of hedge funds, and we can copy it cheaply was for a hedge fund guy, and not just me. Like, I went around and talked to a lot of guys, including Baupost, about this. And they're like, well, of course. The question is, are those the areas that we would be in? Because we do more esoteric things if you're going to do it with futures contracts. So what I thought it did, because it was sort of obvious to me from a non-quantitative perspective, then when I looked at the numbers and you know, over time got more comfortable with how you interact with quants and you work with quants, you know, I was certain that for certain hedge fund strategies, this was the most simple and straightforward way to deliver kind of broad-based returns. And the thing about hedge funds in the 2000s was that the whole space was great. So everyone was just thinking about, you know, like fund of funds, like Rovner had 45 underlying investments, like in your backyard, right? I mean, yeah, it's like, yeah. It was super diversified. Just give money to everybody because everybody's going to do well. And so it was a lot about access and fees and liquidity and other things. And this was just, it seemed to me pretty obvious. And so I, after about 45 minutes, I'd agreed to basically take a controlling interest in his company, fund it. And that by that weekend, I was, you know, trying to write a patent on this thing.
Quick aside, what's a Russian privatization voucher? How does that work?
So when the Soviet Union collapsed, yeah. some academics, including many of whom were at Harvard, got this idea that basically the way to take it from a Marxist-Leninist dictatorship to a capitalist economy was you take all the state-owned enterprises and you create
vouchers
penned stock in them called vouchers, and you distribute them to the population in some sort of a scheme. And so because
there was no corruption involved in that.
Whatsoever. Exactly. I mean, it was people with bags of cash, you know, going around to babushkas and, you know, giving them money for stuff that they had no idea what it was worth. And so look, it was a, you know, the story's been written on that one.
Yeah. Indeed. I'm jumping all over the map here. Sorry. But do you think some of the, where your comment of like all the hedge funds were working, we moved to this period where that's obviously not the case and you have, yeah. Is it more of a case of we've just expanded, we've grown, we've evolved, right? Of now this funds were maybe doing these 50 things. Now they're doing 50,000 things, right? And the categorization and all the different flavors, we've just added way more flavors. So it's hard to say that all are doing something just because there's so many flavors.
I don't think it's so many flavors. I think it's actually that just information and knowledge gets disseminated. Right? Like take managed futures, right? I mean, if it's 1990, like who becomes a managed futures guy in 1990? You're probably in Chicago with you. You're probably connected to Pits. You probably like to program, right? So you're the weirdo on the floor in that you like computers. And you're, you know, and how do you, and then you've got to figure out like futures roles and do all this stuff. Like it was hard to do it back then. Now, you know, guy from the Wall Street Journal, Bob Henderson, just wrote an article about the fact that you've got these kind of things you can pull down, these programs you can pull down and build all of your own trading strategies overnight. So, and you can trade, right? I mean, like, you know, one of the things about even a strategy like merger arb that seems so simple and obvious today, that was esoteric. You know, you had to go call a prime broker and borrow stock. It just, so a lot of the,
Right
a lot
now,
of the
interactive brokers borrow against your holdings for
bargain. I mean,
6 months.
so the whole, you know, the industry goes through this, the technology improves, access improves. I mean, even like the whole GameStop saga, right? Here you had people on, you know, Reddit, in Reddit chat rooms talking about the delta of options at various levels. Like that was like, you know, if you were talking like that in 1990, you were a senior guy at Goldman Sachs or Bankers
And they're
Trust or
just
some other place, you know. Now it's somebody named Hello Kitty or something who's doing it.
Did you watch that movie?
I didn't know.
I haven't seen it yet either. I gotta maybe on the plane this week. Right. Another way to ask that, would John Henry have made his billions and owned the Red Sox and everything if he had started today? Right? Like,
Yeah, probably not, right?
probably not, right? Just
No.
I actually did that back a year or so ago when ChatGPT was becoming a thing. I'm just few keystrokes, like, hey, write me a basic trend following model. And then I'm like, add this filter, add this filter, right? It wasn't even a programming tool or anything. It was just spitting out actual good code for a basic trend following model.
My comment in Bob's article in the Wall Street Journal is basically now millions of people, essentially now millions of people can do what they what their hedge fund idols have always done, which is create things that look great in backtest and lousy in once they go live. That's true democratization. You can be as dumb as your idols.
Listeners have heard me say this on the pod many times, but I when I started my first business, Attain, they I was showing my dad this spreadsheet, like, we were gonna do this, and he's like, nobody's ever lost money on a spreadsheet, son. Okay, perfect. So fast forward, you leave the hedge fund business, you have this meeting, learning about replication.
So I think you know we're gonna find a way to create, you know, almost index like products for the hedge fund space. So first problem is everyone I spoke to hated it, hated it. And I'd never been really on the fund to fund side of the business, the consulting side of the business, or the wealth management side of the business. I didn't really know those things. And you know, as I got to know those sides of the business, I realized like, oh, you love like all these myths you guys talk about hedge funds. Well, hedge fund guys don't believe that, but you believe that because that's how you've sold your portfolios of hedge funds to your end investors. You know, I found that there were it was deeply threatening what we were doing, right? Because if it worked, the entire multi-hundred billion dollar fund of funds industry was essentially worthless. I mean, in fact, one of the one of Grosvenor's competitors in Chicago, who shall remain nameless but nearly as big, I found out years and years later that they ran internal replication models to see, you know, could we actually do better than our portfolios of these flags, you know, our portfolio of greyhounds? Could this robot dog do better than our portfolio of greyhounds? And it did better. So they shut it down, didn't tell their clients about it
I,
because it's an existential threat for them.
yeah, destroy that
So
computer.
yeah, so what I
Although, why
found,
couldn't they run it and still run? Yeah, they could have just run it and charged the same fees. Who knows?
well, or you know, or you integrate it in some fashion. But again, the people who've gone into that business, you know, they like picking funds. You know, if you're running a fund of funds, or you're a consultant at who's covering hedge funds, you get really rich and powerful people who will come and kiss your ass to get your attention, to get approved, et cetera. And you have to fly to Florida and go to the conferences, and everybody wants to talk to you. It's a very heady experience. When you then say, oh, and by the way, now I could be compared to this really cheap, simple way of doing it with six futures contracts. If that does better than you, then you're stable of carefully, you know, selected thoroughbreds. Not a good look. And then
And
if
look,
you do it, and you didn't do the thoroughbreds, then you look bad as well. Anyway, so it took years and years and years and years to find a market for what we did. And like a fool, I stayed with it and paid everybody to come to work with me for about 10 years as we were trying
Yeah.
to figure this out.
There you go. Hey, you gotta have a vision. Gotta have the faith.
Not a great vision.
But talking about that is the vision that this can, the replication model, and we'll get into the details in a second, but is the vision the replication model can be better, perform better than the average, than the top greyhounds, as you called it? Then what is it trying to be better or cheaper, or in that it's cheaper, it's also better?
Well, it's so, and that was sort of a something. So, in the beginning of replication 15 years ago, it was hedge funds are amazing. We don't care about fees because they're magicians. And so, if we could just get what they're doing after fees, but with liquidity and low fees, it'd be wonderful.
Yeah.
They're not, no, people don't think they're magicians anymore, right? And so one of the actual the funny things about replication, right, is when you look at the broad industry, is the broad industry really isn't that interesting. It's I mean, you look at these guys over time, the equity markets go up by 10, they go up by 3. Equity markets go down by 10, they go down by 3.
Yeah.
Think about it. So what it did in a sense is replication actually shined a light on the fact that across the overall industry, hedge funds as an asset class is really not that interesting. And
When
which is
it's a
actually
broad brush of hedge funds, mostly we're talking what I would call,
equity long
yeah,
short,
exactly.
event driven, relative value. Now, look, now there are some within it that are superstars, right? I mean, Ken Griffin happened to be in my college, I don't know the guy, but happened to be in my college class. You know, that's a guy who he's the Michael Phelps of investing. Like, I mean, just wired. Somebody called him the Elon Musk of money. Like, it's just, I
Yeah.
mean, the guy's just incredible. And he will do things at a level that this is why he's the greatest of all time. But the other, you know, 99 out of the other people, other 100 people you put in a pot, probably they're going to do well, but you're not so much if you invest with them. So the thing about replication, right after the crisis, we started thinking, just taking a step back and thinking about GFC. I mean, we started thinking about, like, you know, what do we do with this tool, right? I mean, hedge funds are not covering themselves in glory. And we sort of realized that actually, no, I think we can actually do better, right? If hedge funds make 10, you get 6. Now, replication is not perfect by any means. It's an approximation, but we're pretty good at getting 8 or 9 out of the 10. And if we can do that efficiently, maybe we'll give you 7. Maybe we'll give you 8. Sometimes we'll even give you 9. So it became this very, very interesting thing where you can, by being efficient, you can outperform that which is expensive. Now, if you're a sovereign wealth fund, who can go to hedge funds and command fees because everybody wants, you know, ADIA to invest with them or something, we don't bring as much value. But if you're a, you know, high net worth investor, if you're a wealth advisor, et cetera, who by the time a product gets to you, it's either watered down or has high fees or something, then we can offer you something of real value. So the big pivot in our business turn was really around the mid 2000s, late 2000s. Mid 2010s through late 2010s, we realized we need to be talking to people who build model portfolios in the wealth management space. Those are the guys we can help.
Instead of endowment and whatever, who
Endowments, pension
maybe.
plans, et cetera. Because look, we're basically you know, how can we ruin your career allocation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's when Cliff Asness was at the Managed Futures CME Award night they used to have here in Chicago, that big shindig. I'm blanking on the name, but they gave him the like Lifetime Achievement Award, and like all these CTAs were in the crowd snickering of like, he's the one who like launched models with low fees. Like, are we sure we should be giving this guy an award?
Yeah.
Touching on Citadel or Millennium, like there's certain places and certain ones you can't replicate, right? Whether because of their scale or their access, like where does that line get drawn, or
Sure.
do you care? Yeah.
So, by the way, I would say like every 6 months for a number of years, people would come to us and say, "Can you replicate this not to be named fund?" And it's Millennium, right?
Millennium,
It's
right.
always Millennium. We're like, the only thing we can replicate when you do a factor analysis of that fund, you don't find any visible factors except money.
Yeah. The factor is they have a money tree in the
Money.
background. Yeah.
No, because you can't do that. You can't do illiquid strategies. There are really only two things you can replicate really reliably, which is equity long short, and managed futures. Equity long short, because it's these big shifts, they dial up or down their equity exposure, they get out of value into growth, they pivot from the US to international. It's those kind of big shifts that happen pretty slowly. And that, but again, that would be the equivalent of within that group, there's always some guy who's killing it this year,
Yeah.
and there's another guy who's doing terribly. So it's really designed to kind of give you really index-like exposure, which for a hedge fund allocator, it's not very exciting. But for if you build a model portfolio and you're saying, I've got these, 15 different asset classes, and one sleeve of it is equity long short, it's a way of getting almost diversified low cost exposure to a strategy where you think because of the fee differential, you're likely to kind of consistently outperform over time. That's compelling. So it works in really equity long short, and it works in managed futures, and people have tried it in other areas and it doesn't work.
And what are your thoughts? I can't remember if I was Corey Hofstein, I would have the author and the date of the paper, but right there was the paper that once a factor becomes known, basically the factor ceases to exist, right? And it's hard to make money off that factor anymore. So what are your thoughts? That was, I think the paper had long short equity was one of the examples of, right? Of like, if you put all these classic long short equity factors, they're well known now, and the premiums come way down, if not negative or flat.
So yeah, I mean, I guess my so I know Corey really well. He's a super friend of mine, and I and he actually has jumped into the he used to invest with us. Now he's jumped into the replication business. So he has ETFs that compete with us, and
We
I'm
had
all
a
in
pod with
favor.
him last year called Replicating Babies and something else. So
There
go
you
listen to him. Yeah.
go. Yeah.
He
Well,
was
he had
having
a
a
baby.
baby.
He had
Yeah.
a baby.
Replicating humans, right?
Look, and we are all in favor of it. Anybody in this space will tell you that I'm all in favor of more smart people coming in and trying to figure out ways to deliver it. I guess I would differ with him on two points. One is that by the time the papers are written, it's probably already all over. Not that it's known by then, but that the world changes. So by the time Fama wrote his great value paper in 1992, there were no Fama value stocks left. I
Right.
know, because when I went to work for Seth
You were
Klarman, I
trying to
went
get
looking for
them, yeah.
them. And I also knew on the LBO side, if you had these big fat pitch companies sitting there with a lot of assets on it, and you could borrow 9-to-1 leverage from I forget the guy's name, but who was the big guy at I think it was at Bank of America. He was doing all of this kind of the
Wow.
senior tier
Yeah.
leverage buyouts, and then you had junk bonds filling the rest. Well, they bought them all. They're all gone, right? So value didn't exist by the time Fama wrote the paper. Momentum didn't exist by the time Carhart wrote his paper, is the way they talked about it. Now, you can argue, or you can, if you want to be a little bit more cynical, you'd say nobody writes papers that where the end result is, sorry guys, we looked and it's all noise, right?
Yeah.
Everybody has to come up
Right.
with
That one
interesting
goes in the
conclusions.
drawer, right?
But I think also but I think as it relates to hedge fund, it's in part that, but it's also this, just it's also, I mean, there are a zillion hedge fund guys now. There were dozens of firms, not thousands of firms, in the early 1990s. I think what's interesting about managed futures, though, because I think people like I think managed futures has been in a 20-year process of 30-year process of commoditization. It's easier to get the information. It's easier to build the models. More and more people have, as great as Man AHL is, you've got Man AHL,
Yeah.
descendants sprinkled everywhere. You've got Winton descendants sprinkled everywhere.
That's a funny man cubs versus tiger cubs,
Yeah,
right? Man
exactly.
cubs.
You also known as babies.
Exactly.
But yet it had its best year ever in 2022. Right? And so, because, like, by that same logic, right, equities are commoditized. know, bonds are commoditized. So the fact that the fact you can easily access something or create strategy, right? Like, how hard is it to create a long-only equity strategy today? Right? You and I could do it by the time this podcast is over, right? But it doesn't stop the asset class from being interesting. And so what I think people miss about managed futures is people like to look at it in isolation and, you know, this guy is building a model that's going to beat that guy over time, or that guy's model is better, or he's made some tweaks to it. But to me, it's managed futures against everybody else, because there aren't many flexible and nimble strategies out there that are good at pivoting and changing their positions when we go through these big regime shifts. Because every one of those pension plans, endowments, advisory firms, model portfolios, et cetera, they have sold their clients on it's good to be slow. Our job is to be slow
Slow is fast.
with a steady hand at the wheel. We don't panic, right? Sometimes you should panic, right? In early 2022, if you have a 60-40 portfolio, you should have been
Panic.
panicking, but their job is not to panic. Now, the beauty of managed futures is beyond a certain point, like, you know, I mean, because they're always looking in the rearview mirror, they don't have memories. They don't care. They didn't tell people that they had some great macro call on rates staying low. So it's I fell in love with it as a strategy, as a non-quant, because I realized that every instinct that I have as an investor, something goes down, I want to buy it, right? It's got to be tethered to some intrinsic value. Something goes way up too much, it's got to come down at some point. And if I were to build a portfolio, it's going to be built around those kinds of principles. But the nature of diversification is you don't find a lot of guys who think like you. You know, you find people and strategies that do things differently. And so managed futures to me is just so interesting in that it's the single most valuable thing that I found to bolt onto that 60-40 portfolio. It really adds some value to it, as opposed to most, like private equity doesn't add value to 60-40 portfolio. It's equities.
Well, you could argue you could switch swap the 60 with it, but and I've always thought, let me know your thoughts on this, right? Does so maybe the factor would break, maybe it does break from time to time in managed futures because it's so well known, but because of the drawdowns, because of what happens in the normal managed futures profile, people flood back out, which then reinstates the factor back to, right? You know what I'm trying to say? Like, is the natural cycle of it keep it from breaking long term? Like, if everyone stood with it through the tough times, would it quote unquote break?
I don't think so. I mean, think of the big trades in 2022. You short the yen. You know, you buy oil in the first quarter. You're short treasuries throughout the year. Maybe you're shorting equities at some point. I don't think those were capacity constrained trades. Now the guy who's trading softs, he's going to start hitting a capacity wall much faster. But the space as a whole, I just don't see it. I mean, the space really hasn't grown in 10 years, and everything else has grown a lot. The risk of it is the same proliferation risk that you see in every other strategy, in that, you know, by the time we get to, or it's the fact that you know, sometimes managed futures are like mosquitoes toward a flame, except they're going toward a propeller, basically. And, you know, and so by the time, you know,
The flame doesn't sound so good either.
it's like equally bad, a flaming propeller. You know, in early 2022, there was talk about inflation coming back, but in terms of putting money behind it, it was still a very contrarian trade. You know, it's why certain macro hedge funds had their best year ever. It's why certain, because most people who had told everybody by the end of 2021 that rates were never going up, it's very, very hard to unwind. It's very hard to call your clients and say 3 months later, sorry guys, because again, it wasn't obvious at that point, right? And so, but again, managed futures have this beautiful ability to just lean into it once they see the tea leaves. They're not worried about getting whipsawed, right? They're not worried about being embarrassed. They're not worried about the trade running on too long. So the absence of those characteristics is very, very powerful. By the time you get to the fall of 2022 or end of October last year, that instinct also sets them up because they've got their chin out, right? While human beings are saying, I don't know, you're still short treasuries across the board.
You sure about that?
There's a lot of, have you looked at the leading indicators recently? Nope, because I'm a computer. And so, and
Have you
that's not what
listened
I
to the
look
Fed
at.
minutes?
Exactly. So, but again, even in the last 2 months of last year, which was a terrible time for managed futures because it was really like the mother of all whipsaws on the rate side, was still that's okay because everything else in your portfolio went up. If everything in your portfolio, stocks and bonds had a correlation above 0.8 last year. Corporate bonds had a correlation to the S&P of 0.9. High yield had a correlation of 0.9. REITs had a correlation of 0.9, right? This is not good for
Bitcoin.
diversification risk. Bitcoin has a correlation of 70 if it's possible, but that was mathematically conceivable. I think so. I guess it's to me, I'm always thinking about it as this is a tool in a broader portfolio set. And when you talk about, people sticking with the investment, it's got to have a role like that. It can't be a trade. It can't be, I'm going to get in and, oh, as soon as there's like sunlight coming up, I'm going to, dump it and go back into equities.
Which is now a huge trend, right? Of like, I'm going to put it with the equities in a single investment to hide that line item risk because people are too behaviorally stupid, for lack of a better term, to stick with it,
Have
and
you had
see what's.
Eric Crittenden on from Sanford?
Multiple times.
All right, okay. Second podcast in a row, I'm gonna say the guy's a genius for saying that. I mean, he is. No, he's absolutely right. And Abbey Capital has a fund that does it as well. It's people invest in things that they like. We as investment managers, we'd love we want to try to convince people of the logic of it. Here's an ETF with a negative correlation to the S&P 500, 800 basis points per annum of alpha, right? If the investment is scary and they're going to have trouble explaining it to a client, if they make a 5% allocation to something like that, it's not meaningfully going to change their clients' lives. It's going to meaningfully make their lives better if their clients like it and feel like it's valuable in their portfolio, and it's going to help them to grow their assets and to sleep at money at night. But zero of those clients in 20 years are going to go back and say, can we do a comparative analysis of what that conversation we had in 2023 as to whether this raised my Sharpe ratio over the subsequent 20 years? It doesn't happen, right? As you say, you can't the spreadsheets versus reality.
And I've always loved the efficient frontier, and like the Sharpe goes up 0.02 or something, right? And you're like, does anyone really care, right? Their volatility was 50 bips higher and their return was 10 bips higher. Like,
I
okay.
was on, well, like it doesn't, because literally no 5% allocation to your portfolio, unless it's a lottery ticket, is going to meaningfully change the risk return of that portfolio. You're going to have a 98% correlation to that which you had yesterday. And if you kill it during the next crisis and this asset outperforms by, 20%, you're going to have changed your life by 1%. It's so. So I think, I mean, a lot of asset allocation is, I mean, back to your point, I was on I was asked by a university to help them look at proposals, and they had eight consulting firms had made proposals to their existing portfolio, and every one of them completely changed the portfolio. Like, this is terrible. We should change this, change that, change this, change that, add these 12 different asset classes, da, 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 da. And it was like the same Sharpe ratio. But that business exists because there's an audience for it, right? The person at the foundation has to report to trustees, and they want to be able to show them an analysis that shows. I mean, it's very much of it, it's very theatrical. Asset allocation is very theatrical in a lot of ways, and I think what Eric did and what Corey is trying to do now is to take, and we're doing it, trying to do it in a different way. Is to listen to the audience. And one of the great problems of managed futures, I think, is that they haven't cared about the audience, that they're used to talking to the family office, who's, the European family office, who's had managed futures since the 1980s and will always have managed futures. And or they're used to talking to the institution where they've got a consultant, a guy who covers only macro funds and loves to go around and talk to all the 20 constituents of the SocGen CTA index and write reports on who's doing what and who's not. And that's works in that audience. It doesn't work for somebody who's not neck deep in the space. And I think Corey is addressing something around, where are you going to take money to put it into managed futures? You got to take money from something, and that raises the risk that you're wrong. So you take it from equities, and then equities outperform, you look bad. You take it from bonds, and bonds outperform, you look bad. So maybe you don't have to take it from anywhere.
Put it on
Um,
top.
and then and then Eric's addressing a separate issue, which is, you and I both agree this is a great investment, and you and I both agree it can be awful in certain years.
Yeah, and
And
we
if the
both
S&P go
agree you won't stick with it during those off seasons, right?
because the business of people is not winning an argument. The business of like advisors is not winning an argument to prove to their clients that they would give them the better Sharpe. It's to keep their clients happy,
Yeah,
and
right.
it's to keep their clients engaged, et cetera. So,
A cynical view would be it's even to like reduce the number of phone calls.
which is honestly, if it helps the clients not to get anxious about the underlying investment,
Yeah, and make that call. It's
that's
all good.
the asset management is very weird in that the entire, like, if you take, like, look at US stock picking, right? We have reams of data that all of these firms out there that do long only stock picking have added zero negative value to clients over the past 50 years. But people still do it,
Yeah.
right? Because, I mean, if you ask
I do
me,
it, right? I have a little play account, just right. It's fun. You get the right. Woo.
but like you have, like, I was, if you ask me, like, what would I do? I think it's a good use of my time to start pulling up 10Ks and looking at companies and try to figure out where I put incremental dollars. Absolutely not,
Yeah.
right? I have much better, much more important, but not more important, but I have like much, much more valuable things that I can be doing, like this. So the asset management industry as a whole offers something of value that is not economic in nature. And I think, the ETF business, in a sense, and a lot of the evolutions in asset management has been hearing, like for instance, private equity, right? There's this, journalists started writing a few years ago about, like, watch, the markets have gone down in 2022, and private equity firms aren't going to mark down, their assets the way they
Yeah,
should.
that was
And
big.
they're pulling the wool over their clients' eyes. Okay, so I called some guys who run private equity firms that I grew up in the business with. I'm like, talk to me about this. And they're like, seriously, we don't care. Like, we really don't care what our year-end mark is on XYZ company. You know who cares? Our clients. And if we're co-invested with those guys over there, and they mark their investment up, same investment more than we do, they're more aggressive on the way up and more aggressive in not marking on the way down. It actually makes our investor look bad to his investment committee.
Right.
So it's, I think there's this, I think, what I've learned over time, going back to, my foolhardy decision to get into this business and not really understand what the end audience really cared about, which I think was very naive. My 15-year education has been listen really hard to what people are saying, and think about, are they saying, is what they're saying they want, what they really want? Does it really make their lives better? Because you get people throwing out things like, oh, I want something that has no correlation to equities.
You
Okay,
sure? Yeah.
but why? What is it? What is it that? How does that actually make? If that's a 3% allocation in a portfolio, how does that actually make your life better? And I think it does in many circumstances, but it's not always obvious.
Circle back to something you said before on the capacity and different positions. Curious of your thoughts because you're kind of modeling flows essentially, right? Into and out of different markets. So when you see these articles of Oh, the CTAs are all going to get short here. They're all going to go long, or they're all going to exit. And that's what caused the sell-off. And I'm seeing books of actual positions. I'm like, that's not happening whatsoever.
No,
So, yeah.
look, that's like the media version of CTAs. Like, it's when you read the headline, it's like, Trump lied, Biden stumbled. Like, it's like,
Yeah.
come on, guys.
CTAs, big sellers down
Huge
here.
sellers, this is the point at which they're all going to go short. It's going to be $30 billion of selling,
Yeah.
which has absolutely no impact on anything.
Right. And tomorrow could be 130 billion of buying for some other not mechanism. Yeah. So.
So we yeah, like I think there I think it's I know a lot of journalists. I'm very, very good friends with a lot of journalists, and competition in that space is around finding exciting things to write about. And in the same way that, you go to publish an academic paper, you have a huge incentive to make it interesting. Journalists have a huge incentive to make it interesting. If you read about hedge fund positioning, it's often like, record reduction in net long exposure of equity long short hedge funds from 38 to 37 in 1 week. And you're like, here's the weekly moves, and we've never had a 100 basis point move in a week. It's natural for people to do it, but I think as investors, and I think within the managed treasury space, it's more slow moving and more obvious than I think most people think. At least when I look at our portfolios. Now, what we're doing is very different, right? So the way I think about the managed treasury space is that you've got a lot of really smart guys who build what we call wave detectors. The markets are going up and down everywhere, and they're looking for waves in the markets. If something's going down, they want to be betting on it continuing. This, in general, if it's going up, they want to bet on it going up. And so the bias is, would it be better to analyze 100 waves than 10 waves? Because what if wave 97 is the great wave this year?
Yeah.
Right? And I think there are two reasons people do it. One is there is some evidence that diversification, beyond a small number of instruments does help your risk-adjusted returns. But I think it also sounds great, right?
Yeah,
I
I'm
mean,
in
oh,
430 markets.
have you seen the moves in wheat last month? Or and but the thing is also when you go to 100 instruments or more, you also don't bet the farm on any underlying instrument. So our view when we looked at the space was that actually that information is really valuable. But again, as somebody who, also started a commodity business, commodities move in clusters. If oil goes up over the next 5 years, natural gas isn't going down. It may go up 2x, it may go up, the same amount or something. But, or if, there are underlying things like interest rates are going up, that's going to reverberate through a lot of different markets. So the idea behind replication is not to worry about, whether we're picking up on trade 72 or 73, et cetera, but rather to say what portfolio of the deepest, most liquid instruments, 2 year, 10 year, 30 year Treasury futures, S&P 500, EAFE, EM, Euro, Yen, crude oil, gold, like these really, really big, deepest, most liquid instruments are representative of those clusters. Because, the nice thing about those instruments is you have nearly unlimited capacity, and you also they're incredibly efficient to trade. And when you have a portfolio of them, it's not that hard to understand. You can look at it and actually get a feel as to when you look at the markets, whether we should be up or down today. And so I think if you think about it from that framework, and then you think about this idea of, if CTAs flip from long to short, which by the way will happen much more gradually than people expect, then you see that this is not a strategy that I see having a huge impact, like driving like a tail wagging the dog.
Talk for a second. I get them confused. So you're a top down.
We're top down. Yeah.
Top down. I've always thought until somewhat a couple of years ago that most replicators were, I'm going to bottom up. I'm going to build a strategy that mimics the index. So there, you could do it both ways. You found top down better.
We've had, so yeah, so we, We looked at bottom up, and we actually run our own models. But we use our own models as sanity checks. But we run simple models, right? Like, 50 in 10 days, and 150 in 20. I mean, like all sorts of things to look at it, because it gives us a sanity check on what we're seeing. We are totally top down, right? So we're taking daily performance data of hedge funds and their ilk, and basically looking at a big diversified pool and inferring what their positions are today. And then we wait a week and then rebalance again. So Corey, for instance, uses that as part of what he does. Now the bottom up says, well, that's kind of incomplete. What if in early November or mid-November, it looks like, wow, this is the big one on rates. This is the big pivot. Well, we've also got shorter term models in here. We've got other things in here that are kind of be picking up on that, which you wouldn't pick up on in a sort of simple replication. The reason we didn't do those is because we think the greatest landmine for a lot of investors investing in this space is single manager risk. You have a space with massive dispersion between the winners and losers every year compared to most other asset classes. And with no persistence of returns, no persistence of alpha. So the guy who did well last year is statistically no more likely to do well this year, and is often, often he was wildly leveraged into some trade that worked really well last year, more so than the next guy, and then gets tanked this year. So even if you build a bottom-up model index, like Mount Lucas has a very good one. They have an ETF called KMLM. You have to make a lot of decisions as to how you want to do it. And in general, when you're doing bottom-up replication, you can't keep changing your mind every 6 months, because then you're not a replication, you're just a single manager firm. So you have to, so they're very rigid in the approach. And so, and we don't think the space is rigid. We think the space is more naturally evolved. So the reason we'd like,
So your bottom up might work for 6 months and then it's outdated.
yeah, I mean, KMLM has been, Mount Lucas has been on a tear for 2 years. I mean, they had great numbers the past 2 years. But if they started 3 years or 5 years before that, you'd have a much more mixed picture, right? And same thing happens with our models. And I think it'll happen to Corey, it'll happen to everybody else who does it. So they're great in that they tend to be cheaper and efficient and transparent and easy to understand, but they have limitations. Now,
My classic example is the Wisdom Tree futures that picked Trader Vic's model that didn't go short energies. And like
exactly.
literally after they launched it, there was the huge 2014 sell-off in oil and they way underperformed. You're like, well,
Look,
all right.
and they look in 2022, right? They had a Bitcoin. They added Bitcoin, I think, at the end of 2021. Bitcoin cost them a lot last year and made them the top performer last, I mean, in 2022, and made them the top performer last year. So the whole point is that, when you're investing in space, and that can be great fun for allocators, because you're always trying to figure out, how do I mix and match these guys to put them together into some sort of a diversified package. Our view was there already is the diversified package. It's those, it's the SocGen CTA index with the 20 largest hedge funds. It's the, it's the Barclay index. It's so you already have measures of the diversified portfolios. And again, this is a little bit of the difference in what we're trying to do. A typical guy in this space is like, how am I going to generate the most returns and capture the best trends? It's very focused on them. Our appeal is that we're trying to be the index, the benchmark. We're trying to become the default allocation. If you want to invest in managed futures, we want to be the most simple and straightforward way to get broad-based exposure. What does that mean? It means not betting on Fred or Harry or Yana or whomever else. It means having broad-based exposure to the managers in space, because 3 years from now, when you're sitting in front of your IC or your clients, and they're evaluating how well this strategy did, yes, they'll care whether it went up or down over that period of time. But if the benchmark is up 5 a year and you're flat, that's a much bigger problem than if the benchmark is up 5 a year and you're up seven, right? And if the seven comes from just being cheaper and more efficient, then for a model allocator, we think that's what they were trying to do, because that's what we were trying to do in one of our own portfolios.
The and where do you Where do you think, or where do you aim to land? Well, two questions. One, I'll go back to dispersion. Don't, I've always had a little bit of issue with this of the dispersion. If I look just inside the trend index, right, the dispersion's not as great.
No, trend is much tighter.
Right. So it's a little like, yes, CTA, but that's because we have 72 different things inside the CTA index, some short term, some discretionary, some. So putting that aside for a second, and there's many things you can do to lower the dispersion of like, okay, if I vol weight them and I have guys that only have 5-year track records or right, there's a few things you can do to really tighten in that dispersion.
Unquestionably, we're not a sea change from what people do. Right. So an institutional investor is going to pick six guys in the SocGen CTA index. Obviously, not all six long-term trend guys. Right. And they're going to mix their bets around. And that package, though, right, is going to look a lot like the SocGen CTA index over time. Because that's where they're trying to get diversification. If you only love trend, right, and you think that actually the real driver, and I personally think long-term trend is the most valuable thing within the managed future space, most durable thing. You can pick Alpha Simplex. You can pick, if you're brave, you'll pick Dunn Capital. If you can pick a lot of people in the space, a low cores market trend fund. There are a lot of things out there that'll give you that. Now, they're all going to have, because the big driver of returns of something of the benchmark, the SocGen CTA Index, is trend and long-term trend. That's a bigger driver of returns than anything else. You'll have an 80% correlation, 83% correlation over time.
Yeah,
We're trying
that's
to
going to
do
be
that.
my question. Why not just take the index and pick the guy with the highest correlation?
We would be the highest guy with the core. We're 90, right? So we're a bit better, but again, it's not night and day. And we've also tried to make it cheaper and in an ETF, which nobody else has really done.
Okay, I'm in there. I've got the high correlation. In any one period, do you have a goal of like, I want to be above average, I want to be average, I want to be in the top five, I want to be right? Like, how are you explaining to investors, like, by definition, you're probably never going to be the best and probably never going to be the worst, but you're somewhere in between there?
Yeah, and usually I would say we're consistently in the second quartile, right? So, and I mean that on, you have to pick like how much of a rolling time period you want to pick. But again, my goal would be whatever the index is up over 3 years, we're hoping to be ahead of it, 1, 2, 3, 400 basis points depending upon it. Last year we had a terrible year by our standards. We underperformed, right? It was the first year that we'd gone through that. What I also tell people is replication is a simplification. It's not perfect. There are two things that can go wrong with replication. Well, three things. One is you can do a bad job of modeling it, which fortunately we haven't done. We've been doing this forever. But you can get very cute on the modeling side, and that's what's tend to blow people up. The second thing is we're going to miss trades. All right. So if you think about those clusters, sometimes you're going to have just think about it simplistically. If we're picking up trades, big trades, the largest 10 trades, but across the space, you've got another 90 trades out there. Most of the time, some of them will be going gangbusters in their favor, and some of them will be getting whipsawed and punished on them. And so they kind of average out over time. So our argument is that most of the time, 90% or more of the time, just by efficiency, will tend to outperform. In January, February of last year, a whole bunch of things that we weren't exposed to went up at the same time. Mexican peso, Canadian front end of the Canadian interest rate curve. Nikkei went up. Like it all, this was all wheat softs were going up. All these things that we weren't touching were going up at the same time. So we underperformed. But the key is, the question then is that something structural, right? Is for the next 10 years, are these guys going to be making money only in these, markets, sort of slightly more far afield markets, or less central markets? Our view, having looked at this for a long time, is that's probably not going to happen. That actually the big clusters, the big drivers. So we didn't change anything, and then we came back in the second and third quarters, and we outperformed. Or we can be too slow. Second risk is we're too slow, because everybody in the managed future space is looking in a rear view mirror, but we're looking in a rear view mirror of their rear view mirrors, and so we can be now. Half the time, being a little bit slower works in our favor.
You don't get whipped in and
You don't
out.
get that whipsawed, right? Because people talk about vol controls and short-term models. Like take an American Beacon, Man AHL, and PIMCO were great in November and December on a relative basis because they have a lot more shorter-term models. They have vol controls. They have all sorts of bells and whistles that basically, somebody's
Keep that from getting wet.
pulling the chute cord, right? But it means that by the time they get to Jan 1, it looks like they're now long bonds, right? So they've pivoted faster, but then now they're betting that rates are going to keep going down, and then it reverses. So the same thing happened in March of last year. They pivoted out of things quickly, and it took them forever to reestablish their positions, and rates started going back up. So our investment and research conclusion is that both those two risks are manageable over time and are outweighed by the amount that we tend to outperform. So just when we started doing this in 2016, we outperformed in 2016, we outperformed in 2017, we outperformed in 2018, we outperformed in 2019, we matched in 2020, outperformed in 2021, outperformed in 2022 by varying amounts, right? Sometimes it was by more than we would expect, sometimes a little bit less than we'd expect.
I'll throw
Last
in
year,
a past performance is not necessarily indicative of future
right, and
results.
la well, and look, last year we underperformed by more than we would have expected because it was like, it felt like, but it's very frustrating. I do these videos, by the way. We talk about it on if you go to dbmf.com, I talk about this stuff because it's, we're very open with our investors about
One I
what's going
think
on.
was, and I was, I had 23 flagged to talk about, so we can jump in there. What made 23 so difficult? I'm seeing some reports. I'm going to get around to writing a blog post about it, like the worst year for trend following of all time, perhaps. Is that what you're seeing in your models and your?
Well, having lived through it, it felt like the year of the whipsaw. Like I mean, it just felt like every time, you felt like you really had that kind of momentum that you felt in 2022. Because I mean, 2022 was a historically good year, but it was scary, right? I mean, you're still holding your yen short down at 150.
When
You know,
the Bank of Japan's like saying all that stuff, like,
yeah.
do we have this?
I mean, managed futures is like that though, right? I mean, you're often, particularly if you're a trend follower, you're going to be in a trade after the money's been made when the commentary is starting to pile on that we're due for a big reversal. Now, in 2022, because you had this underlying regime shift in rates that went on for, 18 months basically, it was the right thing to do. Last year, we start with, the market's utterly convinced in January that we're going to be tapering by the second half of the year. Then February comes around and it's going to be higher for longer. And now just as you're kind of it's starting to work, then SVB happens.
That was
And you have like a three, and you have somebody said it was like a 13 sigma move in treasuries, which I think is, I have a higher likelihood of getting hit by a comet before this call is over.
Eaten by a shark on a comet.
And then you're making money back, right? And by late summer, it's with rates going up, the conversation was about, oh, with rates going up, the market is doing the job for the Fed. The Fed doesn't have to raise anymore, but they're definitely not lowering rates anytime soon. And then Powell surprised the crap out of everybody on November 1st. And so then rates start to plummet from there, and it's a huge whipsaw. Which, because by the time, if you think from a trend following perspective, right, you basically had steadily rising rates since April. And so if you're a short term model, you're short rates. If you're a long term model, you're really short rates. And then it starts to go down. Now, one of two things can happen. Either Powell can say they can start to jawbone. I thought they were going to. They're going to jawbone and say the market's gotten too far ahead of itself. It's something, something, something. And in which case the short-term guys would have been caught flat-footed. But instead, what happened was he basically piled on. He had that second thing where he said, yeah, we're done. And then the market, again, because it's not just a change in fundamental information, it's people racing to catch up. Allocators all over the world who have had no duration going into it
Especially at the
don't.
end of the year, maybe have some window
Oh my
dressing.
God, they don't want to sit in front of their investing committees and look like they missed it. So you've
Yeah, I'm
got
in
to,
there. Look,
oh yeah, look, yeah, December 14th.
and what did your book look like? So I think we mentioned before, you're only in 10 positions ever, right? So for most of that pain you experienced was what, the 10-year, the 30-year, which bonds are part of those 10?
All right, well, it's the 2s, 10s, and 30s, and it was across the board.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was no, so the funny thing about last year, and I think this is just sort of interesting, is to us at least when we looked at it, it was truly a one trade market. So
Yeah.
interestingly, the very best replication we came up with last year was not a 10 factor model, was not a 15 factor model. It was a one factor
One
model.
factor. 10 year?
It was the 2 year treasury,
2 year.
actually. The 2 year treasury. Everything in the markets was moving on the basis of whether what they thought was going to happen to short-term US interest rates. And I mean, you had a correlation of 93 or 94%, and you just tracked along the SocGen CTA index. Obviously, we wouldn't run that as a strategy because the moment we implement it, it will fail miserably.
Yeah.
Because the market gods hate that stuff. It's too cute. But it was just really interesting. So basically, it wasn't just when the reversal happened, it also cascaded through currency markets. If you're short the yen, and then Powell says that the rate hikes are over, guess what's going up? The yen.
Yeah.
So with managed futures, when they lose money, this is when it's usually because they have a lot of, instead of having three or four different distinct clusters, you've got kind of one big cluster expressed with lots and lots of different positions, and that's what happened last year.
Two things on that. One, having the three rate markets, twos, tens, and thirties, isn't, how do you square that with the concept of like, no, we're just trying to have one market per sector or one, right? When they're clustering and I want to identify that cluster with one market, or it doesn't have to be one, obviously.
So the research that we did back in 2015, 2016 was to do this well, you need all four asset classes: equities, rates, currencies, and commodities. But even within the context of that, the first models we ran were only four factors, one in each market. And I published a short note in Institutional Investor last year showing the results of that. It works
One
great.
market per sector, per
One
asset.
mark, one market, or one instrument per market.
Yeah, got it.
And look, it worked. It works embarrassingly well for a business that sells itself on complexity.
On 78 market, yeah.
Yeah, but we are very, 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 we try very hard not to fool ourselves. And the great problem in modeling is how easy it is to fool yourself that you found something special and sustainable. So we looked at a million different ways. We looked at different combinations of random instruments. And I think what got me comfortable, the first guy that I worked for wrote this book called Margin of Safety. And in a sense, on the statistical side, we're trying to find something that has what we'd call statistical margin of safety. If we took our 10 factors and replace them with 10 different factors, our results don't change very much. If we changed our window lengths that we're looking at over time, it doesn't change very much. We change the way. So that, for somebody who's modeling, is our measures of stability and durability. And then, is there kind of an underlying rationale behind it? We were trying to find a balancing act. We want to expand it so we get more diversified exposure. And there's sometimes having like this month where we've been long the S&P 500 and short emerging markets against it. Working great.
Good train.
Good trade, right? That would be an awful lot better than just having the S&P 500. Knowing these markets, it could hurt us in a month or in a week or something. But so it was really and we were also very sensitive from day one to liquidity and execution costs. So we're fairly big. We've probably got $1.5 billion in managed future strategies. And my guess is, relative to anybody else in the space with those kinds of assets, we are a very unattractive prime brokerage client
Yeah.
because we only
Well,
we do, we just don't trade the stuff that they make a lot of money on.
let's quick go over the 10 markets. So there's
Sure.
twos, tens,
Twos, tens,
thirties.
thirties, crude oil, gold,
That covers
S&P
commodities.
500, EAFE, and emerging markets, and then euro and yen.
And then, so the EAFE and emerging must be your thinnest markets
Yes.
out of those
Yeah.
futures.
Yeah.
And then This popped into my head as we're saying that. So if 23 was bad because basically there were a bunch of disperse, right? The dispersion expanded and there was some outlier moves. Like you could argue that that whole post 20 2008 great period for managed futures, volatility came down, Fed cut rates to zero. That whole period, that zero rate period, I could argue made it all one trade. Kind of right. Like things, you didn't have all these multiple bets, especially in trend following portfolios. So if you modeled it during that period, any concern that if that Jan Feb kind of right, we start to see way more dispersion, do you have to expand the portfolio?
Yeah, well, look, we look all the time at whether we should. One of the things that and we will expand it if we feel like we need to, and there's a good underlying basis for it. I'll give you an example. Like in I think September 2021, maybe September 20, natural gas was up like 34%, and oil didn't move much, right? So going into that, the way our models would see it was basically, let's say you've got a dollar in natural gas and a dollar in crude oil, we're going to see, 1.2, dollars of crude oil or something like that, basically, and so our exposure didn't participate at all. And when we ran it, we said, what if we had, we was like, why did we underperform the stock to CTA index last month? And it was pretty obvious, right? It was like, okay, well, because we don't have crude oil. So if we'd had crude oil, sorry, if we had natural gas, it
Not
would have been
good.
a 7% position. And so we would have made 2 points. So now the question is, okay, do we think September is unusual? Or is there a reason to believe that somehow crude oil and natural gas, which are normally very similar, are now somehow going to be moving in a lot of different directions? And we didn't think there's any fundamental or economic reason. And so, then we go back and we look at 20 years of history and we say, let's do it again. What if we'd had natural gas? Would it have made the models function much better? And our conclusion, whenever we look at this stuff, almost has always been, sure, there are going to be periods of time when it helps. And there'll be periods of time when it hurts. And in sum, does it meaningfully improve our correlations? Does it meaningfully improve our returns? So we have a pretty high bar for changing it. And, when I talked to clients about it, I said, the measure of success, right? We started doing this 7.5 years ago, and we haven't changed a thing, right? And we've outperformed maybe 90% of the constituents of the Soc Gen CET index since we started. Because if you do a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit better over time, you kind of climb your way up from the second quartile up, well, up into the first quartile. But that's very unusual in quant land, because usually they come to you and say, oh, we've made all these great changes to the model. You only make changes to the model, things not working. You don't say, oh God, we have this thing, we're killing it on these trades, but we're gonna park them aside for now because we think it's too much of a good thing. So we're going to introduce these new things on top of it. So it makes it very hard if you're trying to evaluate something over a long-term perspective. And the investors we want, are thinking about, I want this in my portfolio for 10 years because I can look back and see 23 years of history of the space and however long we've been doing it. For those guys, consistency and stability ends up being quite important. So our goal would be, our hope would be, 10 years from now, we can say we still haven't changed the model. Because if we're saying that, it means it's been working well enough that we don't have to.
And how many people do you run into that just blows their mind? Like, wait, no, you can't do this with 10 markets. What are you talking about? And you're a month delay, or right? Do you rebalance weekly or monthly?
We bounce weekly.
Weekly. So you're a week behind by
We're,
definition,
I
up to a
mean,
week. Yeah.
we yeah, because the space is a lot of daily data. So we're seeing Friday's numbers by the time we rebalance on Monday, but
Okay.
we're looking at a couple of weeks, so there's a week or two of delay in it.
Yeah.
And when you just sort of average it out, it was smart allocators, like PhD caliber allocators who are seasoned, grizzled hedge fund allocators, think what we do is obvious.
Yeah. Right. They
People
just
who
think you're a
run.
marketing firm. Like, okay, you put this in a nice package and are selling it.
Yeah, it's they've some of them have done the same analysis themselves,
Yeah.
and it doesn't surprise them at all. If your job is to pick individual funds, it's more challenging for people to buy into it because a lot of their manager selection is around the 10% that makes this guy different for the next
Right.
guy. And people in the space, at first when I started going on podcasts, as after the ETF was launched, it was early 2022, I do this thing called Top Traders Unplugged with Niels from Dunn
Yeah.
Capital, and a lot of, I think, people in the space were very skeptical, and they were highlighting a lot of the limitations of the strategy, and we're very open about the limitations of the strategy. So it's not like it's, but it was, but I think it's caused a shift in thinking. And the reason I wrote that thing in Institutional Investor was because people would say, 10 is, you're not getting enough diversification with 10. You
Like
need to
at
have a
four,
lot more than that. And then I said, well, actually, you're not that far off if you do four as well. So part of, look, part of my job though is that, as what we're doing is a bit different. It requires a lot of time talking to people and explaining it and why we made the decisions that we made. But again, and I think also, look, I think it's also, for me, it's talking to an audience that where we can be helpful.
and then. My flip side of that question is what percent of your assets do you think don't even know that it's replication or don't even, they're just seeing a number and knowing the category and like what you're doing performance wise.
I think I've spoken to most of our investors. I think the investors fall into, I'd say probably maybe three broad buckets. I think there are some people we have who just probably see the numbers and invest in it. It's easy to invest in this ETF and they just go buy it.
Yeah.
Another group are more sophisticated, and we have these one-on-one conversations about what we're doing. And often they think, okay, it does something very valuable, very efficiently, but I want to pair it with something else. Look, I mean, hey, it's not, I mean, ManHL or PIMCO will do better than us in November and December. We'll do better than this month. Like, it's
Right.
sort of predictable. So it can be kind of 1 + 1 is 2.2. So we just become a tool in their portfolios. And I think the third group, though, are people who, even though they're investing in a quantitative product, like if I was an equity long short manager, they wouldn't be trying to look over my shoulder and say, did he calculate EBITDA correctly there?
Yeah.
How do I know he's reading that footnote correctly?
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
They hear me talk about how we tried to build something, first for ourselves and one of our most important clients, and then brought it into an ETF, why we make the decisions that we make, how that there are human beings who don't sleep a whole lot because they want to make sure this thing is doing what it's supposed to be doing. And if we could be very clear about what its objectives are, how we think it can work in their portfolios, then whether
Yeah,
the
nobody's
mechanics of
surprised.
replication, the number of instruments, it doesn't really matter. It's like, oh, I'm not going to invest that in that equity manager. He's only got 17 positions, not 43. It's
Yeah.
just, it's, well, he must,
Well, it's
if I
funny
think
you
he's
mention
really
that because
smart.
that is often articles of like they're not really doing anything. They're only in four positions, or, right, for some of these equity
Yeah,
hedge
they
funds.
hold positions for a long time. But the thing is, like, when you're, it's hard not to do things in this business.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that plagues quant
Yeah.
investing.
Hard not to add bells and whistles and
Yeah, I mean, so look, you mentioned kind of the bottom-up replication stuff. A lot of that started with banks in the mid-2000s, early to mid-2000s. And the stuff they generated on average was garbage.
yeah, the risk
But
premia platforms and all
the
that.
risk premium platforms, I mean, this stuff had negative Sharpe ratios on average. It was the studies that were done showed that they'd show you a backtested number, it would go live, that the Sharpe ratio would drop 60 or 70%. And so, but why, right? The incentive structure is all wrong.
Yeah.
You've got quants there who have 37 different products. There's great pressure to crank out the next one. You make it look as good as it can. The marketing goes, guys try to go sell it. They hope it works. You're probably not going to be at the bank in 3 years
Right. They're
when
just get stuff on the shelf.
get
We
it out,
created
get it
this
out, get it
store,
out,
get
get it
stuff
out
on the
and sell it.
shelf.
So it's not surprising it's going to be bad. I mean, the fact that I'm the fool who got into this business, 10 years before I realized
Yeah.
it was interesting. Like, it actually gives you some gravitas that I am. This is not something we just jumped into to try to sell somebody a water product.
Last bit here, along those lines, what do you think the limits of replication are? Like, we both know what guy here in Chicago does, like venture capital replication, and he's working on healthcare replication. I was at a talk where a guy's like, here's how you can trade lithium futures when there are no lithium futures by replicating it with copper and short gold, whatever it was. So, like, what are your thoughts on just some of that more esoteric stuff of, are there limits to it, or what are the dangers of that, right? Of like, hey, I can replicate X by doing Y.
So the only one I know well is private equity replication. You're talking about DSC out there? Are those guys? Or yeah. Great guys and terrific firm, and they've actually made some important innovations in what they've done. And they have, I think, a very credible way of going about this. When you look at private equity, actually, it's a lot harder than it sounds. This whole industry, the problem with this whole industry is we have a massive selection or survivorship bias problem, in that when something is working, you will have no problem finding out about it. When it stops working, people bury it quietly and hope you never don't look too hard. And so you can go back and look at some credible people who launched private equity replication products that did much, much, much worse. Same thing with the risk premium products, right? If you went to an AQR or a BlackRock and said, but as they were launching their multi-strat products, and said, what do you think is the probability that you'll be down 30% peak to trough in the next year or two? They
Like
would have told you it's
zero.
impossible. Zero, right? It's impossible. We're doing 6% a year with a 6% standard deviation, no correlation to anything. And then it happened, right? If that was a stock picker, that's the guy who his first three picks are frauds, basically. And so, but so private equity replication can have some of those issues. People have tried to do it. So look, lithium, I have nothing about lithium futures. They may or they may not work.
Well, there are none. That's what it's like.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm saying, so our sense is that replication works in very, very well, in at least the way we do it, in very limited circumstances. And I never went down the private equity route because I think you're taking away the thing that people like the most about private equity. And I've had enough conversations with people who at institutions who their very favorite thing about private equity is it doesn't go down as much. And they mark it up, and it's slow moving, and they don't have to watch it every day. They don't get any surprise calls from investment committee members figuring out what's going on. They love that it's not mark to market. And so you make it liquid,
Well, you could
and
replicate that. Like, hey, just turn off your computer and don't look at this thing for
put it in a
6 years.
drawer.
That's
Yeah, that's
a
that. Okay,
replicated private equity.
that was Buffett's argument about the S&P 500. He's put 95% of the S&P 500 and don't look at it. But they can't not look at it, right? Because they have reporting. So we didn't do it for that reason. I also like there's some also I think there's some arguments that there's been a huge guys that I know in this space. I think there's been a transfer of wealth when the by the time you got into the mid-2010s, the typical bond investor was so outclassed by the private equity guys, and they were so desperate to put money to work, that you had these, they were getting, issuing bonds with like no covenants and crazily risky companies with 5 or 6% yields. These guys were designed to sweep up that opportunity. So I think that, the answer is that I think these things always change over time. I just, private equity at replication, I think you can make it work. It's not something we decide to really try to make work.
Awesome. I think we'll leave it there. We've had you along enough. Any last thoughts before we go?
No, I hope the year of the whipsaw was an anomaly. I hope the you know the firing on all cylinders of 2022. I think the world is going to be a lot more volatile. I think it's a much harder to get diversification than it was for a long time, and it's probably going to continue. And there's a actually very good editorial in the Wall Street Journal today about The market seemed kind of calm when you think about the smoke coming out of the windows of various corners of the world right now.
Yeah, exactly.
And so my guess is that we're in one of those periods right now where there was this collective sigh of relief that Powell wasn't going to, deliberately drive the economy into a ditch. But then now we're going to start, even as we're seeing with, uh-oh, maybe rate hikes are going to be around. Wait, the government's not going to stop spending money. Maybe people, are not going to stop spending as money as fast as we thought. I think you could see, I think it's going to be a challenging number of years, a lot of headwinds to face through, but.
I was listening to a Chicago interview where the con some consumer in the grocery store was like, the government's saying inflation's down to 3. This stuff price hasn't changed. I've been coming here every week. The price of, I can't remember what he's pointing at, a can of soup or something. He's like, this price hasn't changed. It's not down at all. And so it's like, well, I think he's talking about the rate of change. Like, we're not going to wade into that. But yeah, but people have that, right? They're like, prices aren't down. They've just stopped going up.
I mean, look, Powell is, Powell may have pulled out the unthinkable,
Yeah.
right? I mean, I don't know of a serious macro guy who thought you could, land this plane on a postage stamp,
Yeah. Yeah.
which he may have done, or, it's or we're gonna see some, more interesting happens at this point. But
Awesome.
as I
Well, thanks, Andrew. It was great talking with
thank you
you.
so much for having me on. It was great to
We'll hook you
talk.
up next time in New York.
And I'll be in Chicago next month. I'll give you a shout.
Awesome. Appreciate it.
All right.
All right, that's it for the show. Thanks to Andrew. Thanks to all of you listeners for giving us that 2 month break. I needed it. Thanks to Jeff Berger for producing. Please go subscribe and be sure to catch us on the next episode. Peace.
You've been listening to The Derivative. Links from this episode will be in the episode description of this channel. Follow us on Twitter at RCMAlts. And visit our website to read our blog or subscribe to our newsletter at rcmalts.com. If you liked our show, introduce a friend and show them how to subscribe. And be sure to leave comments. We'd love to hear from you. This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of RCM Alternatives, their affiliates, or companies featured. Due to industry regulations, participants on this podcast are instructed not to make specific trade recommendations nor reference past or potential profits, and listeners are reminded that managed futures, commodity trading, and other alternative investments are complex and carry a risk of substantial losses. As such, they are not suitable for all investors.